Conversations about sexual assault and child abuse are not easy and are often emotionally charged. But it's important for us to have these difficult discussions in order for us to learn how to keep ourselves and our loved ones safe. Raising awareness about sexual assault and child abuse is our topic today on the West Side. Good morning, I'm Claire Neipert. Coming up a little bit later in the program, we'll be talking about the FRC's Positive Parent Program with Jennifer Eddy, the Executive Director at the Eau Claire-based Family Resource Center, and the Outreach Program Manager, Brooke Berg, from UW-Madison Extension. For the next several minutes, though, we'll be talking to Caitlin Wonderlin, who is a sexual assault victim advocate from the Bolton Refuge House in Eau Claire. If you have questions for our guests, we'd like to hear from you. Our number is 800-228-5615, and our email address is ideas@wpr.org. Caitlin Wonderlin, welcome to the program.
Hi, good morning.
So for those who aren't aware, what is the Bolton Refuge House?
So the Bolton Refuge House, we cover kind of a lot of things. We're in Eau Claire, Jackson County, and Buffalo County. It's basically a safe space for anybody who has been affected in any way by intimate partner violence, domestic violence, and sexual violence. So we cover all of that, whether you are an adult or a child. It's everyone is included as long as you've been affected by those issues.
Your title is Mobile Sexual Assault Victim Advocate. Can you talk about the scope of your work?
Yeah, so mobile is an interesting piece because I am the outside person. So while we have sexual assault services for in-house, I am more of the let's talk to the community. Let's see where we can support survivors in other places. Let's see how we can get the community involved with the work that we do. So it's been a very interesting thing, especially because I started this job during COVID, which I'm sure everyone is very well aware of how that might be a difficult thing to navigate. But really, the community response has been great. There's a really beautiful camaraderie that's happening, especially in Eau Claire, with recognizing that the work is very important and that this issue is very important. Mm. And despite the fact that we are in a global pandemic, there's been a really, really great response. Mm.
What made you decide to want to get into this work?
So that's very interesting. So I actually was a teacher before this, teaching English in Japan, which you would think, like, how does that have anything to do with being a sexual assault victim advocate? You'd be surprised. So a lot of what I do is education for community members or for people who are survivors themselves. And I'm able to use a lot of the techniques that I use as a teacher in order to spread awareness and spread information in a new and unique way. And I think just personally, I've always been very involved in the prevention of sexual violence. That's always been something very important in my life. So I think that this has just been a really great opportunity for me to be able to work through an organization like Bolton Refuge House that's already very well established, and that I can kind of bring a new spin and a new perspective on it to try and raise awareness.
Thank you. So into our questions. The advocacy group called End Domestic Abuse in Wisconsin reports that the pandemic has led to a worldwide spike in domestic violence. Have you seen that play out locally as well?
Yeah, I think that that's a very interesting thing, because what the pandemic has done is it's created what one survivor called the perfect storm. So now there is heightened stress levels because of things like the pandemic, like job loss, like more stress on certain services. And also it's removed tools that survivors have used before to keep themselves safe. So survivors are the expert. They know exactly what they have to do to keep themselves safe. They know what is right for them. And what the pandemic has done is it's taken away a tool. A tool meaning I can go to work and I am in the public view. People will see me. People will check in with me and I have that visual. Or I can take my kids to school. And so maybe they're not witnessing any of the violence or they're not having to be part of that. And so because that tool has been taken away, a lot of survivors have had to change the way that they are maintaining their own safety. And I think especially when it comes to sexual violence, and especially when you think about the LGBTQ plus community, that's a big thing that now you can't find these safe spaces that you've been able to rely on in public. So you have to look to online where there might be not as much regulation. You can't find as many people who share your opinions. And there's also a lot of pressure socially to maintain quarantine. So when you are the survivor of a sexual assault, some people have disclosed that they find it hard to say, hey, I survived a sexual assault because they have to deal with, I also broke quarantine. Mm. So that's been something that's really changed a lot of attitudes. But I think being able to talk about it and being able to say, hey, you never deserve to be sexually violated. You always deserve to feel safe. And that if you feel unsafe, you should be allowed to disclose that if you would like and to access whatever services you need.
What has the pandemic done in terms of how people report abuse?
So I think that's very interesting, because if you actually look at the reports of sexual violence, even in just Eau Claire County alone, data from the Department of Justice from 2015 through 2019, the reports have gone up very much. And I think that you might think, oh, wow, this is such a problem. But when they really started to spike is after the Me Too movement. So after people were realizing, I have been a survivor of sexual assault, those reports have gone up. And similarly, I think now that we're in a situation with so much online presence and so many places online, that more people are being able to have that moment when they realize, I'm a survivor and I did not realize that I was a survivor before. So with the pandemic, I think access to that information and access to being able to get help or to seek support from other people who have gone through different things, whether those are people that you know in your real life or people that you just get to find, I think the pandemic has had a very interesting effect on people being able to recognize that they are a survivor.
Let's talk then about how the pandemic has impacted the Bolton Refuge House. How have you found a way to meet the pandemic-driven demands and reach those populations that are particularly vulnerable?
I think that's a great question. We have stayed open, kept our doors open, just maintaining CDC guidelines. And that was something that we as an agency were very focused on, being able to still be available, to still be there, and to still be a visual force for survivors to access. Because a lot of times social isolation goes a lot along with violence, whether that is domestic violence, intimate partner violence, or sexual violence. The isolation that you can feel in that moment is a really, really tough thing. And then compound that with social isolation just from pandemic reasons, that's been a really tough thing. So for us, being able to still be there and still being able to even just be a physical place that somebody can come in and talk to an advocate 24/7 on a holiday, any day that you need to talk with somebody, I think has been really cool. It's required a lot of staff conversations, really making sure that we're all trying to be as safe as possible in order to achieve that, but really understanding that we want to be here and we want to be available for survivors anytime.
And I read on your website that a lot of the work that you do at Bolton Refuge House is actually in the form of like support groups and outside of the actual physical property. So how have you adapted those groups in order to fit the pandemic?
Yeah, I think you've touched on something really important, is that a lot of people think of us and they think of the shelter piece, which obviously is a big thing that we do, but that's not everything that we do. That's only actually a third of our services. So with those support groups, it's been a lot of working on what is our biggest location in our building that we can have distance with people. We've switched to more virtual, even sometimes being able to have meetings virtually or on the phone has actually given a new tool to some survivors who might not have been able to have the transportation to come down, who might not have been able to leave their situation and come down here. Being able to have that virtual option, I think, is something that I can see lasting in the future to really be a good tool, especially for those who don't have access to transportation, who don't have access to being able to get themselves from one place to another, or those who are experiencing homelessness and might not be able to get to a new location without help from transportation. So being able to have those groups be virtual, or with my job, actually, it's been cool to be able to go to where the survivors are, to meet them exactly where you are, and wherever you need the healing, we're going to be there. So that's kind of how we've adapted with the pandemic. And I hope that will last for a longer time, because it's really had a beautiful response.
That's the voice of Caitlin Wonderlin. We're listening to The West Side on the Ideas Network, where we're talking about sexual assault. Next, Caitlin, I kind of wanted to transition into talking about changes in perception and attitude surrounding sexual assault. Bolton Refuge House is actually celebrating its 45th anniversary in 2021. So since then, since it's starting, how have attitudes changed toward response to sexual assault?
I think that's really interesting to look at, especially because I think sometimes sexual assault is something that is not often discussed. A lot of times, I think people will get nervous when they hear that sexual assault piece and they're like, oh, well, that doesn't happen here. We don't want to talk about it, not in our community. But I think the more that we're able to talk about it and bring it to light, the more we're able to all of us work together to prevent it from ever happening. So I would say that something that I've seen almost just anecdotally, is more people being aware of the entire gambit of what is covered by sexual violence. That so many things fall under that umbrella that I think now we're getting to a point where we're able to center the voices of marginalized communities and we're saying it's been one narrative for too long and that narrative is not even being recognized enough. We need to really center the voices of marginalized people, of BIPOC communities, of LGBTQ plus communities, disabled communities. And I think that now is a really special time when we're able to center those voices instead of only focusing on one narrative for so long. I think there are still many, many attitudes that happen socially. And I think that, I mean, many of us can probably come up with some examples now of things that are still pervasive in our society, of attitudes that have, of the what were you wearing conversation, things like this that we still see. But I think now is a great time to take that conversation and ask, what are we saying with this? What are we actually telling survivors? What we need to tell survivors is we believe you. You deserve to feel safe and you deserve healing at all times, bar none. And I think now is a good time when we are able to have those conversations more publicly. And those are becoming something that more people are able to join into that conversation with the digital space.
On that topic of inclusivity, I think, at least I think, when people picture a sexual assault victim or survivor, they often think of a woman. But actually, one of five adult Wisconsin men have experienced sexual violence in their lifetime. So why is it that we so often leave men out of this conversation?
I think that's a great question. And I think that a lot of times we think of exactly what you're saying. One person is kind of what we think of. And I think there's a lot of things that contribute to that. I mean, one could be media. When you think of examples of what is sexual assault, it is a woman and it is exactly this. And this is the justice that she receives through the Justice Department or the law enforcement or whatever mechanism fits the media better. But I think that is not the case. I mean, exactly. You've mentioned a great statistic, and the more that we can expand our definition of what covers sexual assault, the more that we can make ourselves available for survivors and tell them that their experience is valid. I think that part of that just comes down to a long time of reinforcing that. I'll even still look up materials now to use in support groups where they'll use the word her or she all the time, which completely leaves out the experience of males or non-gender conforming individuals or people of trans experience who experience sexual assault at a very, very high rate. 47% of trans adults have faced sexual assault. And that's something that we can no longer ignore. We have to address and we have to work together to help our trans siblings. And I think that that's exactly something that I'm glad that we're able to have this conversation now and talk about this now is to be able to bring that to light.
Bolton Refuge House actually has a support group for LGBTQ plus individuals too. Can you talk a little bit about your plans? Do you have any plans to sort of expand that outreach like you're talking about to make sure we include everyone in this conversation?
Oh, definitely. I'm glad that you mentioned that because that's a very near and dear to my heart is that support group. And our partnership with the Chippewa Valley LGBTQ plus Center has really been a beautiful partnership for getting that group going and really increasing the visibility and the access for survivors to talk to us. If you ever have had an experience and you want to be able to talk to somebody who is understanding and who is open and who recognizes the importance of those stories, has been really great. We definitely do have plans to expand that programming to make that available for as many people as possible. I think that it's also interesting because the group that I specifically run for the LGBTQ plus population is a youth group. So I always learn like so much information from them. They have some really cool perspectives. So we always have some really interesting conversations. They always have to help me with technology because despite us being in a pandemic for over a year, I'm still like, can you guys see or hear me? I don't know what's going on. And they're like, you're muted. You're fully muted. We can all see that you're having problems. But it's been a really cool thing to be able to have those perspectives and to be able to have those conversations. And exactly like you said, include those populations whose voices are so imperative for the future of sexual violence prevention.
So wrapping up our questions with you here, Caitlin, our next segment is going to focus on child abuse prevention. So how much of a connection do you see between spousal abuse or domestic violence and child abuse?
I think a huge connection. There is so much that goes into all of the violences that we've talked about, whether it's intimate partner violence, domestic violence, sexual violence. And something that we've noticed, especially with the pandemic, is a lot of responses directly related to children, to trying to prevent children from being in that situation. We have heard from survivors that they are finding the need to take action now in order to think about their children and whether or not their children are witnessing or being exposed to violence. I mean, that's a huge piece of what we do, and I'm really excited to hear kind of the next segment for this show as well. Hopefully I'll get to learn some more because that's something that we all have to focus on. I think you're exactly right where that we often think too much about one narrative, the adult woman narrative, and that's leaving children out of the conversation, which children need to be included.
If someone listening today is a survivor of domestic violence, what is their first step in getting help?
So an option for them, as advocates, we always try to provide options. We are never here to tell anybody what to do. There's no judgment. Everything's confidential. If they would like to reach out to Bolton Refuge House, our phone number is 715-834-9578 or boltonrefuge.org if you prefer to do things digitally, as I know I do. Or they can always come down to our 807 South Farwell location. Reaching out can sometimes be a really good thing just to learn options. And everything we do is free and confidential, so that's completely allowed. But if somebody is finding that they are seeking support or they want that, I just want everybody to know that they deserve support and they deserve healing. And whatever that looks like for you as an individual is completely valid. We are just an option, but there are plenty of options. And if you would like to discuss that more, give us a call or stop in or anything like that.
Caitlin Wunderlin, thanks so much for joining us today. Caitlin Wunderlin is a mobile sexual assault victim advocate for Bolton Refuge House, which has locations in Eau Claire, Buffalo, and Jackson County. We have a link of those locations for domestic abuse shelters throughout Wisconsin. You can go to our page. That's at WPR.org. Click on shows, then select the West Side. So that will all be there for you. Caitlin, again, thank you so much.
Thank you.
We're back on the West Side. Our shift now focuses a little bit. April is not only Sexual Assault Awareness Month, but also Child Abuse and Neglect Prevention Month. We're glad to have on for the rest of the hour two experts in the field of family relationships. First, Brooke Berg is the Outreach Program Manager for Family Engagement and Relationships with the UW-Madison Division of Extension, based here in Eau Claire County in Altoona. Brooke Berg, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
And Jennifer Eddy is the Executive Director of the Family Resource Center in Eau Claire. Jennifer Eddy, glad to have you along on the West Side.
Glad to be here.
And you can join in on this conversation by calling 800-228-5615. That's 800-228-5615. Or you can email ideas at WPR.org. That's ideas at WPR.org. So before we launch into our topic, I'd like to share some background on your roles in your organizations. Jennifer Eddy, let's start with you. What is the Family Resource Center?
Oh, thank you for asking. So we've been around for more than 20 years supporting parents here in Eau Claire County and Dunn County as well. We are not so much here to tell parents what to do. I love what Caitlin had to say that, you know, empowering individuals. So parents make their own decisions and they're on their own parenting journey. And we work to support parents along that way. If I could share, I just want to say what a joy it is to be on your show today with Brooke Berg. For 15 years, she was the director of the Family Resource Center, and I got to observe what a great leader she was directly because I was on the board. So it's really fun to see her getting promoted through UW Extension to a statewide leadership position, and nice for us to know that we have friends in high places.
The motto on your website says Family Resource Center because children don't come with instructions. And it made me smile to read that, but it's no joke if you're a parent who's feeling lost. So if a parent reaches out to the FRC for help, what happens next?
So first, I'll just say there are lots of ways of reaching out. Our telephone number is 833-1735. And we have what's called a warm line. So if somebody doesn't answer you right away, they'll get back to you. Otherwise, you can go to our website, frcec.org, to find out all the great programs that we have. And there's so many different programs. Whenever I go to fundraisers, they say, please, Jennifer, stop telling us all about your different programs. It's just too confusing. But you can go on our website and find that out. We do have what are considered trained parent educators. So they're certified in a number of wonderful programs. So they know how to empower parents and support their best practices. You know, parents are often beating themselves up or feeling like they're not doing a good job. And we're here to support parents and let them know what they're doing well.
Let's shift to Brooke Berg. Brooke, you're based in Altoona, but you are a part of the statewide outreach program, and you're the manager for the Family Engagement and Relationships Extension. What does your work entail?
So we at Extension do so many great things in terms of bringing research-based services across the state. So our job is to really take that research from the university and employ that Wisconsin idea so that we can touch people all across the state. And my role as a program manager in family engagement and relationships is really to help support the educators that we have all across the state. Again, in bringing those prevention, education, support services to help strengthen families. We do, we serve all families, but we do tend to target those most vulnerable or underserved populations across the state. We do a lot of different programs focusing on parent education. We do quite a bit of teacher training and community capacity building. We work with justice-involved families, co-parenting, families and technology. We focus quite a bit on helping with the prevention and education around adverse childhood experiences. And then, of course, a big part of what Extension's mission is to really help support community organizations and partner with organizations. And so it is a pleasure for me to still be able to continue my work in partnership with Family Resource Center. We do have a educator that is located to serve Eau Claire County, and she has great partnerships and relationships with Jennifer and the staff at Family Resource Center. And then my job really is to help build that capacity at a statewide level.
Both your Parenting and Family Relations divisions at the Extension Center and the Family Resource Center focus on providing resources for parents, but some aspects of our society project that moms and dads should just like naturally know what to do when raising their kids. So how do you fight that stigma?
I can start by answering this question, and Jennifer, please feel free to jump in. I think we know that it is a very stressful time and it's difficult to raise children. And you're right, there is this societal pressure to just know what you're doing. And part of our job really needs to be to change those social norms about parenting to know that it's okay to ask for help. It is normal to not know all of the answers. And just like the mission of the FRC says, children do not come with instructions. And so I know for Extension, and I can say for FRC too, really being able to build a family's toolbox and for them to be able to have strategies and techniques that might not work every single time, but that they can pull from and have this supportive network around them is really, really important. We know that those official records of child abuse and neglect rates are, they really underestimate the extent of problematic parenting. And it's important for us to recognize that we all face tough times and difficult situations as a parent. Even myself as a parent of four children and someone who has the training and expertise in this area, I myself has struggled, you know, I've struggled with parenting issues and frustrations of children that won't stop crying and, you know, have had to reach out for support as well. So it's really important that as we bring programs to communities that we really focus on this overall family engagement and relationship piece, that we're all in this together and we all have struggles, and that we really shouldn't be pointing out them, those people who abuse children or those people who neglect children. It really is all of us as a community raising our children.
We're talking about this topic of parenting and families in correlation with Child Abuse and Neglect Awareness Month. Brooke Berg, what do we know about the triggers for parents to neglect or abuse their children?
Well, child abuse and neglect are really complex problems that are rooted in unhealthy relationships and environments. And one of the things I wanted to mention was, you know, this notion around adverse childhood experiences and adversity and stress. And one of the things I wanted to note and help people understand is the critical brain growth and development that's happening in children 0 to 5. And so when we think about our youngest children, we know that there are a million new neural connections that are happening every minute, and that we know that experiences play a huge role in which connections are happening and which are not. And this really sets a strong foundation for functions in our life, like social skills and problem solving. And so when we think about issues that might be triggers for potential abuse or neglect, it's this complex situation where we really have to look back at experiences that maybe we as a parent even faced, and know that that brain infrastructure that happens at 0 to 5 is setting that foundation. So when you have a parent who might be at higher risk for abuse or neglect, a couple of things that we want to think about is that parent's own experience with adversity in their life and how that's impacted their ability to problem solve, to manage the part in their brain that is that fight or flight portion. We also want to think about the environment that they're in and a connection with poverty. We know that children living in poverty are 5 times higher than those with higher socioeconomic statuses to be in that realm of child abuse and neglect. So stress, environment, and your own experiences in life really play a big part in your ability to manage your own emotions and manage your own anger and build healthy relationships.
So if I'm a parent who's self-aware that I've gone through some stress and adversity, what can I do in preparation to be the best parent that I could be?
I'll answer that if I could.
Yeah.
I just wanted to reiterate what Brooke said, that if we could do anything to eliminate child abuse, you know, some people might mentally think we could lock up those child abusers. But really, if we could do anything to eliminate child abuse, it would be to eliminate poverty and decrease parental stress. Mm. And I just wanted to say, yes, it's true what Brooke said about ACEs, but it's also true that anybody in a bad situation, whatever their background, can be a child abuser or child neglector. So we really try to focus, unfortunately, since we can't on our own decrease poverty and remove parental stress, we really focus on those coping strategies that she was talking about, that self-regulation. A big part of being a parent is learning how to stay positive mm-hmm. and calm in around our children, because we're role models. So there's lots of great techniques that we can use to do that. And I don't want to make it seem like triple P is the answer to everything, but we currently have an evidence-based program that we're really excited about promoting throughout the state with Brooke's help, but also here in our own Chippewa Valley. And that has been so great for parents. Part of it, so I'll just say, if it would be okay to talk about some of the principles of positive parenting, that is, number one, creating a safe environment for your children. So that's another thought about helping parents kind of really think about, how do you prevent child abuse and neglect? You want to keep your children safe. That's your number one job as a parent. And next, you want to create a positive learning environment. So toys and books and opportunities, but also a loving, warm environment will children have opportunities to challenge themselves and succeed and develop self-confidence. Next, there's a lot about assertive discipline. So setting your family's rules or your house rules up front and letting your kids know what will happen if they violate them, and then being consistent in enforcing them. That's a really positive technique. And last two are kind of having realistic expectations of children. So based on their age, you know, no two-year-old is going to be sitting quietly through an entire church service, or you can't expect a child to stay dry until they're potty trained. So having realistic expectations for kids, but then also of ourselves as parents, right? We are doing lots of things and juggling a lot, and we all need support. And lastly, just taking care of ourselves. I'll say one other thing. Brooke rightly mentioned those first 3 years and the first 5 years in terms of brain development, but I just also want to stress that it's never too late. You know, when we talk about how do we build resilience in children, well, those first years are really, really key. But one of the techniques that we use is learning to name, to identify, and to accept emotions. So reading children's book and seeing, now that's what anger looks like, or that's sadness. And kids may develop that in the first 5 years, and there's lots parents can do to help promote that. But if they haven't gotten those skills down pat by the time they're five, don't give up, right? It's a lifelong learning, even us as parents. I, at one point in my life, remember being in therapy and having my therapist say, "And how are you feeling?" And thinking, "I don't really know." So we can all learn to develop our own ability to become resilient over time. So just don't want to give up if the first 5 years are over.
You just heard from Jennifer Eddy. She's the executive director at the Family Resource Center Eau Claire, and she was talking about the Positive Parenting Program. You're listening to The West Side on the Ideas Network, where we're talking about child abuse. To join in, you can call 800-228-5615. That's 800-228-5615. Or you can email ideas@wpr.org. That's ideas@wpr.org. So, Jennifer, you had just been describing some of the foundations of the Positive Parenting Program. And I kind of wondered, if someone were to join that program, what does it look like? Is it webinars, personal coaching? Can you give us an idea?
Hopefully one day it will mean gathering in person and seeing each other as human beings face to face. But unfortunately, we're not quite there yet. All of our offerings are available on Zoom. And there's a kind of a tiered approach. So, you know, we know parents are busy and they have lots of priorities that they need to pursue. So for a given parent, it just might be signing up for one hour and a half seminar on raising confident, competent children. So we have one of those on Monday, April 19th at 7 p.m. Or attending, I think maybe right now, the most key is raising resilient children, learning how to survive a pandemic and come through it stronger than ever. And that will be May 3rd, also at 7 p.m. It may be a group discussion. So if you're struggling with disobedience, one of our parent educators is offering a discussion group with other parents who are struggling with the same thing. And that's April 30th at 10 a.m. If you're more interested in really mastering all the techniques, so there's like 17 different evidence-based strategies as part of Triple P, you could sign up for a group learning experience. I'm really excited about this. Our parent educator, Brian, is offering this coming Tuesday. So it's every Tuesday at 6:30 p.m. for five Tuesdays. You get to not just learn these techniques, but practice them with each other, with other parents, and talk through how would you implement them with family. So that's really exciting. So those are some of the, and lastly, I should say, one-on-one. So if you're struggling with any of 40 different parenting issues, whether it's tantruming kids or kids who are whining or not doing their homework, we are partnering with Yia Lor at Extension here locally, and also about a dozen other different groups. So whether it's Caroline, we at the Y, or myself, or one of our parent educators, you can meet one-on-one with a practitioner of Triple P to talk through that particular issue going through.
We're speaking with Brooke Berg. She's the Outreach Program Manager at UW-Madison Extension based here in Eau Claire. And Jennifer Eddy, she's the Executive Director of the Family Resource Center in Eau Claire. Child abuse and neglect awareness is the topic of our conversation. Do you have questions or comments? Again, you can email ideas@wpr.org. That's ideas@wpr.org. Or you can call 800-228-5615. That's 800-228-5615. I'm Clara Neipert. You've been listening to The West Side on the Ideas Network. Our topic today is child abuse awareness. Right now, I want to switch the conversation a little bit to the effect that the pandemic's had on child abuse. So even for established families with positive habits, these past 13 months have been unprecedented. Kids are trying to do school from home and parents are trying to work from home. And so, long story short, the pandemic has added new stressors that we've not seen before. Brooke Berg, how have you seen this play out in family relationships?
You know, it's been really interesting. We had some researchers, some faculty members do some initial research right away at the start of the pandemic, really gauging additional stressors for parents. And so parents specifically in Wisconsin reported that, of course, the pandemic was a significant stressor for their family, having negative implications for their own mental health, emotions, and behaviors. Most parents felt that they had some major concerns around work and social distancing interfering with their parenting. 58% of parents reported increased feelings of frustration, and 67% increased worry in their parenting role. One of the other things I wanted to mention too in this study that Extension did was that it also highlighted that many families felt that this brought some unexpected opportunities for strengthening their family relationships. And so although there have been incredible stressors that families have been under, there have been a few positives that have come out of this as well, and that families have really reported that they've been spending more time together. And again, sometimes that can, you know, depending on your family situation, that can be a stressor as well. But we know that the pandemic has really impacted this. You know, one of the studies just came out around a decline by 25% in substantiated cases of child abuse and neglect in Wisconsin over the last year. And really that has to do with, kids have not been around other people who potentially would be mandated reporters. And so families are not being seen out in public as much. And so we know that the cases reported have been less, but we also know that our families are not around those people who potentially would send in those reports. And so, you know, there's a lot that goes into a family structure, and families are complex. And we know that the pandemic has really heightened some of these stressors for families, and it can be a real concern for our most vulnerable populations.
Jennifer, Eddie, how did the pandemic impact demand for the services offered by the Family Resource Center?
Well, I'll say one of our most popular services is playgroups, where children 0 to 5 gather with their parents in our playroom and do a lot of parallel play, but also kind of practice their social and emotional learning. And more importantly, the parents get to know one another. You know, this is a time of life when your kids are really little that you have unique stressors that give you more in common with other parents of kids that age than you might ever have any other time in your life. So we do stress evidence-based parent education, but a big part of what we do as a Family Resource Center is just connect parents with each other, and they probably learn more from one another than they do from our parent educators. So it's just been really heartbreaking that we haven't been able to meet in person. And we know, I'll just reiterate that, you know, one of the big protective factors against child abuse is parents feeling connected to other people, having that social web of, you know, like Brooke was saying, when she was frustrated, she had somebody watch her child and go walk around the block. You know, having people that you can turn to when you're feeling stressed is so important. And, you know, with the social distancing, that also puts a kibosh on that. We've heard from our parents that they cannot drive by the Oakwood Mall, where we're reside currently, without their kids bursting into tears because they can't go to playgroup. So that just breaks my heart. You know, there really is a need to connect with loving people and family supporting people. And it's just really, really hard. We do offer, you know, read aloud sessions over Zoom. We've had Zoom playgroups, but honestly, many young children have just had it up to here with being on computer all day. So it's really tough.
Brooke Berg, circling back to something you mentioned earlier with the differences of being virtual and not being around those mandated reporters so much. Well, now more and more vaccines are getting into arms, and it's sounding like we're going to kind of be headed back to normal, maybe in-person schools for this fall. So do you think the return to somewhat normal marks an end to those additional stressors, or how do you think there might be a residual impact on family life?
Sure, that's a great question. Families have always faced a multitude of stressors, and of course, every family situation is different. And so as we return back to sort of our new normal, families are going to continue to face stressors and to be in environments and relationships that are potentially stressful or unhealthy. And so no matter what transition families are going through, it's really important that each community wraps its arms around our families and their unique situations. We have families that may be living in pretty stressful and unhealthy environments, or children that are living in these environments that will be going back into classrooms more days of week, and that's going to be really great and really healthy for them. And we have families that may feel an added pressure or added stress by going back into environments that maybe were more difficult for their children as well. And so when we think about our community, again, it's this multi-level approach for support, education, coaching. It's being able as a parent to say, hey, I need extra support, or I need some additional resources in this area. And it's our job as community members and advocates for families and children to be aware and to observe our children and to reach out and support families where we can. And when we see that they are struggling, and reducing that stigma, to be able to say, hey, it's okay to say you're struggling. It, you know, for me personally, as a mom, it was a really tough transition when my children were all doing school from home and I was working from home. And now that they're transitioning back, it's just a new, different kind of stress level. You know, we sort of got into our normal routine and it's a different transition now. And so, yes, we may see some more reports because we'll be around people more. But there are just going to be different levels of stress and complexity and relationships that all families are facing, whether we're in a pandemic or not.
The Wisconsin Public Policy Forum released a report yesterday showing that the use of the state's child care subsidies by low-income people in February was about 15% below the previous year. Brooke, what do you think that might mean when it comes to family relationships in the near and distant future?
There's a lot that goes into that. I mean, again, every area of our state looks a little different in terms of childcare. We've got some areas in the state that have some major childcare deserts, and there are not regulated childcare centers for these kiddos to be a part of. And when you think about the difference in particularly women going back into the workforce and our families that don't have access to childcare, that have had to stay home. I mean, that's a really big piece of the underutilized care that's happening. And so hopefully with things sort of getting back to normal, we will get our children back into these supportive education systems that can support the whole family. But certainly, you know, as I mentioned before, these children who are living in rural areas, of Wisconsin and maybe have less access to employment resources, childcare, are at added risk for some sort of abuse and neglect. And it's important for us to keep that in mind.
Jennifer Eddy, kind of circling back to the positive parenting program, your program relies on community-based providers to be the most effective. So what does that training entail, and what kind of individuals or organizations take that training?
Well, first of all, the training is super fun. So if you are providing care to families in this community and are interested in learning more, please reach out to the Family Resource Center, because we are the hub agency that facilitates this training. It is very rigorous. So the reason that the evidence is so strong supporting PPP programs is that people are trained often over several days. They do a pre-accreditation kind of practice, and then they're accredited and participate in a day-long experience of kind of being tested that you get the techniques. The good news is these techniques are so affirming. So this pandemic has been personally quite a challenge. You know, I've been feeling more isolated myself, but the principles of PPP have actually been kind of a lifeboat, if you will. So one of the techniques that all of our trainees use is, you know, it's very common for people to start with what they might have done wrong or what they wish they had done differently as a provider. And we always start by saying, name two things that you did really well. And I find myself, and then what is something you might want to do differently next time? But it's very affirming of like, well, you did some things really well. And I find I've been writing a lot of grants to support the FRC during these challenging times. And I put in one grant that was late and there was a mistake in it. And I started to beat myself up. And here it is, 11 o'clock at night. And I say, what are two things I did well? Well, I submitted that grant on time, you know? So it just is a change in a shift in the way that you look at things. And I think that's really key for parents too, to kind of be not so hard on themselves. But yes, no, we've trained people from the YMCA, from DHS, from all our major medical providers in the communities, which is really amazing. With Augusta and Eau Claire school systems.
Well, thank you so much. That was Jennifer Eddy. Thanks for being on our show. Also, thank you, Brooke Bird, for joining us. And we heard from her a little while back, but Caitlin Wonderland, thanks so much for being on our show. Thanks also to our on-air producer. That was Kate. That was Catherine Thomas today. And Dean Kalmbach produced today's show. Next week on the West Side, we will discuss anti-Asian American and Pacific Islander racism here in Western Wisconsin. We'll have a couple community leaders as guests, and we'll address our area's history of anti-Asian racism and the racial violence that's happening today. We'll also explore community healing and solutions. In addition to the Family Resource Center in Eau Claire, other such child abuse and neglect prevention resources are available in the area around us. We have those up on our page, WPR.org, and then go to the West Side for the link. I'm Claire Neipert. This is the West Side on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.